This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A week from today, we'll be reporting results from parliamentary elections in Iraq, and the first number most people will look at is turnout. In the north and south of the country, areas dominated by Kurds and Shias, respectively, Iraqis are expected to vote in large numbers. The situation is different in the middle of the country, the so-called Sunni Triangle, where many voters either support the insurgents' demand for a boycott or fear for their safety. Though a suicide car bomb injured at least 10 people in Baghdad earlier today, U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Irv Lessel told reporters that there's been a decrease in attacks over the past several days. "We think it's the calm before the storm," General Lessel said. They're saving up for something more spectacular in the days preceding elections and on Election Day. And security is only one concern. A country with little experience with elections has to deal with registration, ballots, voting booths, observers, counting, all of the mechanisms of democracy. On today's program, we'll talk with various people in or recently in Iraq to get their sense of how ready the country is. If you have questions about the logistical challenges, security, and how to measure success or failure, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, the weekend blizzard paralyzed parts of New England, including the presses of the Cape Cod Times, and your letters. But first, elections in Iraq, and we begin in Basra with James Glanz, foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good evening, Neil.
Let me begin by asking you about the announcement earlier today of the arrest of Abu Omar al-Kurdi, who is described as a top lieutenant to the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Who is he? How important is he?
Well, that's a debatable question. A couple of days ago, the Interior Minister here made a sort of a heavy-handed hint that he might have had Zarqawi himself. I was at the press conference, and Carl Vick of the Washington Post pressed him to clarify, and he mysteriously said, "No comment, we'll have news in a few days." Then there was a new tape from Zarqawi, so that sort of scotched that idea. I think what the government is trying to do in advance of elections is develop confidence among Iraqis that they're picking up some of the bad guys. This person is touted as a bomb maker, and it's very significant that that's the part of his resume, his dark resume, that was chosen to be highlighted, because the government wants Iraqis to believe that it is picking up these people who could drive car bombs into polling places. And it's a legitimate tactic. I mean, they're putting more police on the streets, Iraqi National Guard, more American British troops, to sort of develop the kind of confidence that would let Iraqis come out to the polls. And I think this announcement is one of them. I'd view specific claims about his importance skeptically, though.
There was, as you mentioned, also a tape just this past weekend purportedly by Mr. Zarqawi, in which he declared a fierce war on democracy, said anyone who takes part in the election would be considered an infidel. What's been the reaction to that?
Well, I think more of the same there. He's a shadowy figure. We don't even really know if Zarqawi is a single person or a composite out there among the terrorist community. And we have very little sense of what impact he has on Iraqis. I think he's a convenient sort of focus for the ire of the United States and its allies here. But on the Iraqi street, I don't think people are waiting to hear what the latest word is from Mr. Zarqawi.
Okay. Well, the security situation besides, and to some degree, I guess, as the General Lessel was saying in Baghdad today, we'll have to wait and see. How are Iraqi election officials going ahead with arrangements, all the logistical activities they have to complete for next Sunday's election?
Well, it's a huge effort in any situation, you know, in any large country, here 27 million people to pull off an election. It's, of course, a much bigger problem, you know, challenge if you've never done this before. And if you're doing it in the midst of an insurgency that doesn't seem to be slowing down. So you have millions of ballot sheets, you know, 60 million ballot sheets coming in, these bright blue ballot sheets are quite attractive, actually, coming in from outside the country, from unspecified locations. It's all a secret. 90,000 ballot boxes, 90,000 ballot booths. I've seen them. They're little three-piece cardboard prefabricated things, and they've all got to get to their spots. Around the country, there are 500 and 42 district polling offices, sort of central polling offices around the country, and there'll be about 5,500 polling places. All of this is really taking place as we speak. The final voter lists are not even ready in Iraq because there's still a challenge period where people can look at voter lists in their district and say, no, this fella died 3 years ago, or, hey, you left me off the list. So I wouldn't call it chaos, but it's a tremendous logistics operation. Carlos Valenzuela, who's the chief UN election official in Iraq, said it was the biggest logistics operation in Iraq since the war. So that's one measure.
Yeah. You mentioned the registration lists. As I understand it, these are based on the lists that were assembled by the previous regime, the Saddam government, for distribution of emergency food.
That's right. They had to decide how they would go about this. And I think it's well to keep in mind when we start talking about turnout, something that everybody's going to be interested in, that the registration process here is not voluntary. In other words, it's not a self-selected group of people who want to sign up to vote. It's all the people who were on the food rolls and who are determined by, you know, their individual data to be eligible. That's about 14.2 million people in Iraq. It's not clear that all those people are interested in politics or interested in this election. So if the number is down in the you know, the 20% or 30% or wherever it's going to be, I think you have to use a different measure for how successful that is, because of course not everybody who is eligible to vote in the United States actually signs up to be registered to vote.
So that number for success, what are officials talking about?
Well, that, you won't get much of an answer on that. Again, I asked Mr. Valenzuela, who's really the brains behind the whole thing here, you know, what would be your magic number? And he hotly replied, he's very passionate about this, that there is no magic number. There's no benchmarks for success, save one, and that is that the election be considered legitimate in the eyes of the Iraqi people. So whatever it takes to create that legitimacy, whether it's a high number or whether it's just that they feel that Their interests have been accurately reflected in the parties that are elected, I think that's what officials are looking for. That's what will decide whether this election is considered legitimate and binding.
Okay, let's get some listeners in on the conversation. If you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. Right now we're speaking with James Glanz of the New York Times. He's with us on the phone from Basra in southern Iraq. And let's get a call in. This is Andrew. Andrew's calling from Truckee, California.
Yes, hello. I had a question. I have my housemate's actually over in Iraq working in the telecom industry, and he sent in a blog that he's keeping, he was talking a lot that neighbors weren't really standing up for each other, that if people had threats against them saying they shouldn't vote or work with the Americans, that mostly it was sort of the tail between your legs, walk back and stay low for a while. Are there some examples of community groups coming together of just Iraqis not supported by the Americans, et cetera, encouraging people to vote?
Well, it's a very dangerous thing to come out front and say that you're going to vote in Iraq. I would say one thing about the observation there by your housemate there, roommate.
Yep.
You know, nobody's going to overtly admit that he or she is going out to vote. That doesn't mean that that person will not vote. It's just not, you might say in American terms, it's just not cool. And here it's just not safe to walk
right
around saying, I'm going to go vote. So I think tail between their legs, I think that's a little unfair, because I think that Iraqis they're hardy people. They've undergone so much privation and so much horror, really, in the last 30 years. And things haven't gotten much better in the last couple of years for them in their daily lives. So they are tough, and I think that what they say is not always what they do, sometimes for some very good reason. So
right.
there are people out there who will, I think, line up on election day and actually vote.
Excellent. I was just in Afghanistan, and I actually sort of saw this twinkle in people's eye, and they were a lot more confident about saying they were excited about the change. And I guess the hope is that some people have that sort of hidden desire to get out there.
Andrew, thanks for the call.
You see it.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, you see it a bit, and it's harder to find in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kate. Kate's calling from Athens, Ohio.
Yeah, hi. I've heard via media sources that there will not be any international observers at the elections, and I'm wondering if international observers were asked to participate, and if they're not participating, why not? And, yeah, what can you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a real issue. Most of the international observers are going to stay in Amman, Jordan, outside the borders because it's too dangerous. I think the last figures I saw were that there would be about, the number 128 is sticking in my mind, that could be off, but on that order. Now, that's to be compared with, I think, roughly 10,000 domestic observers. These are non-governmental organizations and political parties who will be allowed to watch the counting, watch the voting in different stations. And it is true, it's a real concern. On the other hand, the way that the optimists are pitching it here is that it's really the Iraqis who are carrying out this vote. It's the Iraqis who will determine whether it's legitimate. And they have a very highly developed professional class here. People are going to look at the way the counting is done, the voting is done, and they'll be able to draw their own conclusions. So therefore, maybe it's not a total loss here because you're going to have 10,000 Iraqis at different polling stations watching the process go forward.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thanks, Kate. James, just before we let you go, we have about a minute left with you. I did want to ask what the campaign looks like. Obviously, campaign rallies are sort of beyond the question of safety. How are people finding out about the candidates?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, I was at a televised debate on Al Hurra television in the fortified green zone the other night. There were five, I think, members of the parties. Remember, people are voting for parties, not for people. And then, you know, the parties have lists of candidates on them. And people see that kind of thing. There are a few individual appearances by the candidates. There are posters on blast walls. That seems to be the popular place to put your campaign poster around Baghdad. There are plenty of 12-foot-high blast walls, concrete blast walls. And then of all parties, as it usually is in Iraq, the best organized and most visible and seemingly the most fearless of all the parties is the Communist Party. So you actually see them out campaigning. You don't see anybody else on the street. So if you want a dark horse, pick the Communists.
James Glantz, thanks very much. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Back with more after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Iraq's upcoming election. If you have questions about how it's going to work and what will be considered a success, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us now is someone who's just spent several weeks in Iraq. Earlier, Michael Rubin spent 8 months in Iraq as political advisor to Paul Bremer, the former U.S. civil administrator of the Coalition Provisional Authority. He's now a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, D.C., though he joins us now from the studios of the BBC in Rome, where he's attending a conference. Michael Rubin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
During your latest trip, and in fact, when you were there earlier working for the CPA, you lived outside the Green Zone, traveling around the country talking with different people. What can you tell us about how Iraqis feel now about this upcoming election?
Well, I go back to Iraq about every 2 months, and this last trip, I was in Baghdad from January 1st to January 16th. There was an electricity in the air that there wasn't before. Before, we used to talk about elections, about democracy, and it was very theoretical. Iraqis have registered not only through the Oil for Food program. Many have gone to check their registrations because under the Oil for Food ration program, it only listed the ages of people. People had to show up to give their names as well. You see posters on the wall, and frankly, now you see advertisements on television, and there have been a few rallies as well. It's not theoretical anymore.
There are ads on TV and radio?
Right. Many Iraqis channel surf habitually, because under Saddam Hussein, you couldn't have satellite television. Now that they can have hundreds of channels, it's almost like they can't stop going through them. I was sitting with a long-term Iraqi friend of mine, I used to teach in the university system there, and every few minutes on Shakia, which is an Iraqi satellite channel, or even on Al Arabiya, we'd see television commercials for interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi. I spent several days embedded with the Shia list, the so-called Sistani list. Iraqis actually campaigned by the numbers. There's 100-some-odd parties or lists running, and they have ballot positions, so I spent a lot of my time with List 169. On all the commercials, you see them vote 169, which is the Shia list, mm-hmm. vote 130, which is the Kurdish list. And the Shia were very active on the radio. I'm not sure that the Americans are really monitoring that. And in addition to that, you have most diplomats work between 9 and 5, and then after that, they're workaholics, they write reports to Washington. But most Iraqis, the backroom deals, which I witnessed, happen between 9 p.m. and 3 a.m. I'd be sitting around a smoky back room in someone's house outside the green zone in Baghdad proper, and you would have Sunnis, Kurds, Shia all coming to visit. People, for example, from President Ghazi Yawar's list coming to give the latest news. There were deals being struck about who would get what ministries after the elections. For example, Jalal Talabani, who is the president of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, has reportedly been offered the presidency of Iraq by the Shia. It looks like the biggest fight in Iraq after the elections will be over the interior ministry, because as we hear so often, security is a real problem in Iraq. It's also a campaign issue. Many of the Shia are running on the slate that Ayad Alawi, the interim prime minister, has failed to implement security, and they have better ideas. Interestingly, Ayad Alawi's campaign commercials on television talk about how he will bring more security and, I mean, basically vote Ayad Alawi for a better tomorrow.
Yet we've also been hearing about some candidates, and again, they vote by party list, but they do list names of candidates. But some candidates do not want their names on their party list for fear of their safety or their family safety.
You're absolutely right. This election is going to happen in a very different way, for example, than the American elections. In the American elections, we have, for example, congressional districts, and everyone votes on a ballot for their congressional district, their senator, and the president, if it's a presidential runoff year.
Mm-hmm.
In Iraq, it's done differently. You have more than 100 parties. There's 275 seats in this National Assembly. And Iraqis are voting by a list. For every, I think it's 0.4% of the vote, one person from that list gets into the assembly. Then the assembly itself chooses who their president is, who the vice presidents are, who the prime ministers are. What many Americans are forgetting, and frankly many Iraqis don't realize, is that this election is only a transitional election. What they're going to do is write the Constitution, and then in 11 months, there's going to be a referendum to see whether Iraqis approve the Constitution. So that's the second election. Then if they do approve the Constitution, you're going to have a third election to choose the new government.
So this is going to be a drawn-out process with many votes over considerable periods of time. And indeed, there are also provincial elections being held on the same day. And you mentioned that you were teaching college in Iraq earlier. That was up in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan. And there's going to be a vote there for the regional assembly, where they've enjoyed pretty much autonomy since the end of the Gulf War 15 years ago.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email question from Margaret in Roseville, Minnesota. How dangerous is it to be a candidate in Iraq? Who are the candidates? What sorts of positions are they running for? And are there any women candidates?
Well, the Iraqis are governing their election through the transitional administrative law, which was agreed to, I believe, in early March 2004. And under the terms of the transitional administrative law, one quarter of this interim transitional National Assembly has to be women. The United Nations looked at that and advised that if one quarter of the candidates have to be women, literally one out of every three on these lists has to be a woman. So if you have candidate 1, 2, 3, one of those has to be a woman. 4, 5, 6, one of those has to be a woman. Now, not all candidates have announced their names. Several have. This time, because of the way security happened, I didn't want to live with the Americans the whole time, because then you're isolated from Iraqis,
mm-hmm.
or in one of the international hotels. So I went with Iraqi politicians who had their own security. If they had their own security, they weren't afraid to announce they were running. But many of the people don't. Many of the other candidates haven't. One of the dangerous systematic things about this election is that when you have a list election, candidates aren't accountable to their districts. They're not accountable directly to the people. They're accountable to the party boss. So it will be an interesting dynamic as this election proceeds.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. And Kathy is with us from Salt Lake City, Utah.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy.
I was wondering if the Iraqi people are actually interested in American-style democracy, or if this is similar to forcing Christianity on Native Americans or other cultures that is so prevalent.
I'd answer that Iraqis are extremely interested in democracy. The problem is that Iraqis have very different ideas of what democracy means. For some of them, it could be one man, one vote, one time. But the way the system is set up is very different from the American system. It's set up, the United Nations, in consulting with the Iraqis, talked about different models, the East Timor model, what happened in Cambodia and other places, and they're actually following a pretty unique situation going forward. And the fact of the matter is that, again, this election's only transitional, and the Iraqis are going to write their own constitution. No one's going to dictate to them how that constitution needs to be read. The one danger I could add that comes up here is that Iraqis don't have a lot of experience with democracy. And because of that, for example, many watched the American elections with interest. And the American elections were announced almost right away. I mean, within 12 hours or 15 hours. It's going to take about 2 weeks for these elections, the results to be announced, because the ballots have to be moved to the international zone to be counted. And then the candidates have to be forewarned for their own safety, who won, so that they can arrange their security before the announcement's made. So you're going to have 2 weeks of a bit of a vacuum with various people questioning the legitimacy of the elections, different people claiming victory, and so forth. I'm a little bit worried about what happens not during Election Day, but during the following immediate 2 weeks.
But the analogy, our recent presidential election than Afghanistan's election.
True. In Afghanistan, the election was interesting because, I mean, there were many threats against the Taliban, made many threats, and election workers had been killed, perhaps not to the extent as in Iraq, but the elections went forward rather smoothly. My own self, I get the sense that on election day, it will be calmer than we expect, because the Iraqis who do engage in terrorism do so to have the maximum impact. And if their terrorist attacks are the day before, then they can frighten Iraqis. If the terrorist attacks happen and Iraqis don't have a chance to hear about them, the election will proceed just fine. We'll see what happens.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Lance. Lance is calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Lance.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, your earlier guest mentioned... that the election would be considered, you know, what's the benchmark for success? And the benchmark is that the Iraqi people consider it a legitimate election.
Well, that was what the UN head there said. But go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So my question is, how indeed do you measure that when there are at least five different groups within the country who are some participating, some not participating, some which will likely consider legitimate, others which reject it already, and others which may reject it afterwards? How do you make that work? How is that going to happen? What's being thought of in terms of addressing those issues?
Yeah, Michael Rubin. Thanks, Lance. Michael Rubin, certainly some groups, Shia insurgents, Sunni insurgents, and indeed some Shia insurgents too, would say no matter what the turnout is, it's not legitimate.
That's true, and I think you can imagine that a lot of those who lose the vote are going to claim that it's not legitimate. This is part of democracy. It's part of a slow process. Now, many of the Sunni insurgents and some of the Sunnis in general, they're not afraid that elections won't represent them. As James Glantz had said, they're afraid that the elections truly will represent them. The fact of the matter is the Sunnis are only about 15 to 20% of the country. And when you talk to Sunnis, when you talk to Iraqis in general, different groups or communities, if you add up what they say their percentage of the population is, you get to around 200%. That's going to be a real problem, but that's part of the process. And again, this is only the first election of three. The second election is going to be a referendum, flat out yes or no on the Constitution. And therefore, even if some people choose not to vote or are intimidated against voting, they will have a second vote and a third vote before any permanent system is implemented.
Let's get another caller in, and we'll talk with Paul. Paul's in St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, guys. My big concern is that, assuming that this election does go through and somebody legitimate and recognizes legitimate takes takes over. What if they don't want to allow democracy to flourish and just end up being a dictator?
It's an excellent question. It's one of those questions which the Iraqis talk about all the time. The characteristics of the Iraqi groups, though, is that even, first of all, there's a multitude of political parties. Whatever happens, whoever wins in whatever proportions, they're going to get into this National Assembly, but no one is likely going to have the majority. There's going to be a lot of horse trading. Likewise, when you talk to Iraqis of different groups, be it Kurds, be it Turkmen, Arab Sunnis, Arab Shia, many Iraqis are not as maximalist as oftentimes people outside of Iraq picture them. Frankly, every time in Iraqi history where one group has tried to dominate, it's ended in civil war. And if there's one thing Iraqis agree on, they're exhausted and they don't want war. Many Iraqi politicians I talk to, whichever ministries they're going to take or they want, say that within this constitutional process, they expect the final constitution to look like the transitional administrative law, which was a compromise. It was ideal to none, but fair to all. Now, the real question is going to happen with regard to what the nature of religion is in the state. And this is going to be played out in, for example, family law. If a woman wants to get divorced, does she have to go to the mosque or does she have to go to a secular court in the state? It will be interesting to see how that plays out. But with regard to Iraqi dominance, of one group trying to dominate the others, I don't really see that happen. I do think that there will be some real fights with regard to security and also with regard to not whether the Americans should stay or leave. Many Iraqis agree that the Americans should stay, although the nature of how they stay, the status of forces agreement, where they stay, is another issue that they will be debating quite actively.
Thanks very much for the call, Paul.
Thanks.
And Michael Rubin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Rubin was an advisor to Paul Bremer at the former Coalition Provisional Authority, now resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, and he's with us from the studios of the BBC in Rome. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR in New York, News. Iraqis living in country are not the only ones eligible to vote on Sunday. Iraqis who live abroad are also eligible. For the past week, Iraqi expatriates in 14 countries have been registering. Joining us now to tell us how it's going is Peter Urban. He's the out-of-country registration and voting program director at the Organization for Migration. That's a Geneva-based group that's overseeing the Iraqi expatriate vote. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
The registration deadline has been extended a couple of days. How come? And evidently, we've lost the line to Peter.
No.
Oh, no, there he is. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, we definitely extended the deadline in order to give the Iraqis yet another chance to come forward and participate in this process.
Thus far, the numbers of Iraqis living abroad who have registered is low.
We had originally estimated that there was about 1 million to participate, and we have found up until now that about 240,000 have come forward to register at this point. But it is obviously the choice of the individual if they wish to participate or not. Our planning numbers is not indication of everyone that will participate, but only those who could participate.
As I'm sure you know, there's been some criticism about the relatively small number of registration sites in various places, including in this country. People have had to drive many hours or fly to cities across the country in order to register. How did you decide where to put places?
Well, originally the plan was only to have one site per country and provide what is often called capital-based voting. We went out of our way to expand this this program, even though we only had 67 days to put it in place. And we went for the five locations where it was determined that the larger Iraqi communities were, or where it was a central point for these to gather.
We just have a few seconds left, but I did want to ask you about security. Obviously, not as much of a concern outside Iraq as inside. Nevertheless, there has to be some concern in places like Amman, Jordan. And with that, I suspect Peter Urban's cell phone has given up the ghost, at least for today. We thank him for joining us on the line from Amman, Jordan. He's the director of the Out-of-Country Registration and Voting Program at the Organization for Migration. And we do thank him for taking the time to join us from Amman in Jordan. When we come back from a short break, we'll pick up our discussion about the election in Iraq. We'll be speaking with John Lee Anderson, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, whose stories on Iraq have been very important both before, during, and after the war. 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now, we'll continue our discussion on whether Iraq is ready to vote for its new leaders. The current interim prime minister is Iyad Alawi, chosen by American and Iraqi officials last spring. He's a secular Shia whose past is full of mystery and intrigue. Iyad Alawi is among the hundreds of candidates running for seats in the Transitional National Assembly, which will have 275 members. The body will write a new constitution and then select a new prime minister. Alawi hopes to be chosen in that role, but faces challenges from several other candidates. John Lee Anderson, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, recently returned from Iraq, where he had extensive access to Iyad Alawi. He interviewed him several times in both Jordan and Iraq. He writes about this complex man in the current issue of The New Yorker. John Lee Anderson joins us now from his home in Dorset, England, just after finishing his most recent tour in Iraq. Nice to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
How would you describe Iyad Alawi, both as a man and as a politician?
Well, he's quite a personable man when you sit down with him. He's an intuitive guy. He's somewhat Zelig-like, in which he anticipates where you're coming from and seeks to agree with you, especially if he senses that you're going on controversial ground. But I found that over time, I gained more and more insights into him and was able to sort of derail him at times from his sort of set pattern of conversation. He's a family man. He's a man with a lot of secrets and a rather unreconciled past. In a sense, all of that flows into his public political persona. He's a canny politician. He's shown that in his mettle as a politician by surviving the vagaries of being in exile and coming out on top when he was nominated as interim prime minister last June. And indeed, in using these last 6 months to be a man who shows himself to be someone willing to use power and indeed to possessing it. While he's derided as, of course, as an American puppet, and to a large extent he is contingent on their goodwill and their military muscle in the country, he nonetheless has shown himself to be a man who is fairly independent as well.
Here's an email question which hits on some of the things you were just saying. Do you know if the American administration favors any of the candidates or lists, or if the administration is funding any of the parties? That from Ellen Robbins in Baltimore.
Good questions. First of all, on funding the candidates, well, of course, we have an overt and covert. We have overt and covert policies and agencies in our national makeup in our government. So although there is no overt funding of Mr. Alawi or other candidates, I would imagine that there is covert funding. His Iraqi National Accord, which was created with CIA and British intelligence funding and Saudi after the Saddam's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, has been pretty much bankrolled ever since by the American intelligence agencies, and I don't imagine that has stopped. I do understand that it continues. And what was the other part of the question?
And the other what about funding for other parties?
Again, we know that Ahmed Chalabi, the other famous former exile politician, had his funding of $300,000 per month to his Iraqi National Congress cut last spring after he was accused of passing American intelligence secrets to Iran as part of his fall from favor with the United States. Apparently, Mr. Alawi's funding has continued.
As we look ahead to this, what does Mr. Alawi say about the prospect that he will not be reappointed prime minister, that he will have to hand power to someone else?
Well, he takes, you know, I asked him that question, and he takes it in his stride, as any good politician would, and says, well, you know, it's the will of the people. And but I pressed him on that, and he very much took the stand that he intended to remain active in Iraqi political life. And I have to say, in his behavior, in his most recent performance as Iraqi prime minister, and in his body language, he certainly doesn't seem like a man who is thinking that he's going to be out of office anytime soon. And this brings me back to the early part of the last questioner's inquiry to me, which was whether the United States favors him. And I would have to say that, yes, off the record, the U.S. does seem to favor Mr. Alawi to remain, while our diplomats and officials vehemently state and restate that this is an Iraqi process, that they favor democracy, and that the free will of the Iraqi people is what should prevail. However, Iraqi politicians of some standing told me that off the record, the U.S. has made it fairly clear that they do have three caveats, that the next, you could almost call them conditions, which are sort of hanging in the air over the process and over the various candidates. One, that the incoming Iraqi administration, the next government, should not install an Islamic theocracy, that it should not ask for the American troops to leave, and I believe there was a third condition which escapes me at the moment, but they are all of a similar sort of style.
And what do you make briefly of the statement we heard over the weekend that from various Shia sources that any elected government would not elevate Islam into the place of primacy in the Constitution, that it would be secular at least on its face?
Correct. I mean, these statements are very much in response to the unofficial American concern, which I just I relayed, and I would have to say that based on my dealings and understanding of the more religious Shiite figures, I would tend to agree that that's the case. I think they, for the most part, are people who have learned from the long years in exile in Iran that a harsh theocratic state is not possible, and under current conditions in Iraq, with the Sunni community, terrified of that possibility, and indeed extremely hostile and fighting along sectarian lines because they fear that possibility, that they would abstain from the more confrontational policies which we would associate with that. I think they're planning to go slow.
And finally, John Lee Anderson, have you thought about what number or numbers in your mind in terms of turnout, what's going to, in your mind, decide whether the Iraqis accept this election as legitimate or not?
Well, I would not venture a guess on numbers. I just cannot. I don't think anybody can at this point. Nobody. It's a very surreal election process in which, even some of the lists where the candidates are, their names are not on there because there's fear that they'll be killed, not to mention a lack of almost any visible campaigning. To the degree that a majority of the Sunni community will not participate in the vote, the results of the election will inevitably be seen to be incomplete and therefore to a certain extent vitiated. To the extent that the Islamists who are carrying out, like Zarqawi and others who are carrying out the sectarian killings aimed at goading the Shiites into responding, are able to continue to bloody the process, we will continue to have a political scenario that's extremely volatile and difficult to predict in Iraq. The war will continue, I think, whatever happens with this election.
John Lee Anderson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His profile of Iyad Alawi is in the current issue of The New Yorker. He spoke to us from his home in Dorset, England.